So I am going to really quickly review, as I did last week, the big picture of Deuteronomy, the words of life, God's instruction for how we relate to Him in covenant. Again, the overall message of this book is that we would choose life. And life is defined as being God's people in God's place with God's presence. That's what we want. We want to live our lives in the presence of God. And to do so, we must always be obeying what He said, His precepts, in light of what He promises. He has great promise for the hope for and hope for the future. And in light of that, we obey Him in the present. And that's how we live as His people in His place. And that's how we continue to abide with His blessed presence. And that's really what Deuteronomy is seeking to get the people of God to do, to choose that life. Not life as the world presents it, not life as those out there worship their gods, but as God Himself has presented it. And that's really what we're doing, what we did for the first part of the year of 24, and what we found in the second half of 2024 is that these 10 words of life, as we call them, is like a summation of really all the book of Deuteronomy's teaching in how to live life. If we want to know in summary form what it is to live life as God intended, then we look at these 10 words, and it gives us a summary. And I'll come back at the end of the lesson today in the handout and show you some of the ways that Deuteronomy does, or that the 10 words do that. So this is, in essence, a crash course for how to choose life. Now, let's go ahead and you can go to Deuteronomy 5, verse 21. And the plan is to take probably about half of our time, a little over half of our time on this, what we've done every week, and then to come back at the end with the looking at the whole. So let me begin, as we've done each week, with this jarring translation. And again, this is something that is meant to make us think about this as we would be approaching it for the first time. So let's go ahead and read together. You can read on the screen, or you can look down at your Bible. You will not crave the wife of your fellow man. You will not desire the house of your fellow man, or his field, or his servant, or his maidservant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything which belongs to your fellow man. Let me say that again. You will not crave the wife of your fellow man. You will not desire the house of your fellow man, or his field, or his servant, or his maidservant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything which belongs to your fellow man. So now I just want to do, as we've done really each week, to focus in on a few of these words, a few of the most important words. But just before I do that, one thing that I haven't done throughout, originally when I planned this series, I had planned to take a week at the end to talk about the differences between Exodus and Deuteronomy. I'm not going to have the time to do that, and so I'm going to do that really quickly here. I'm going to show you, and there are a variety of questions that this brings up, and that's why I wanted to do it in a full lesson. But if you read Exodus 20 and the Ten Commandments there, and then you immediately go to Deuteronomy chapter 5 and read the Ten Commandments there, or if you put them side by side on the page, you are actually going to notice a number of differences. Now, actually, a number of those differences are in Deuteronomy, in this verse about coveting, but there are some other differences elsewhere. And so I want to talk about some of the differences, and I actually want to put this up on the screen for you. So if you take the NAS of Exodus 20:17, which is about coveting, and then Deuteronomy 5:21, which is about coveting, now I'm going to read the NAS of both. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. So now what I'm going to have you do, I want you to keep your eyes on Exodus 20:17, and I'm going to read Deuteronomy 5:21 and see if you can notice some of the differences. So here I go. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not desire your neighbor's house, his field, or his male servant, or his female servant, his ox, or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. So if you were working your way through Exodus while I was reading Deuteronomy, there were a couple things that you noticed there. So I want to talk about a few of them. First of all, you probably noticed that there was a difference in order. Specifically, in Exodus, the neighbor's house is mentioned first, and then wife is mentioned next. Whereas in Deuteronomy, the order is reversed. The neighbor's wife is mentioned first, and then his house. Why is this? Well, as you can imagine, different people have different ideas about why this would be the case. It seems to me that a good explanation is that Deuteronomy is making clear that the wife is no mere possession of the neighbor. The wife is not possessed in the way that other possessions are possessed by the neighbor. Though surely there is an appropriate and exclusive right possessed by the man for his wife, she is very distinctive from other possessions. I think that another potential explanation is that Deuteronomy is highlighting the value of women here. One of the things that many have noticed about Deuteronomy is Deuteronomy, in particular, highlights the value of women in a very distinctive way, especially in the broader ancient Near Eastern world. And so it would make sense that in Deuteronomy early on that distinctiveness might be highlighted. And so I do wonder if that would be the case. One other potential explanation that will be more clear in the next point is that the list that comes after wife in Deuteronomy is found in many contemporary lists of possessions in the ancient Near East. So when you look at legal documents and transactions, and there are many of these, and not just in one nation surrounding Israel, but in a number of nations, you will find that this list, minus wife, is included in a number of places, where it'll say things like, male servant, female servant, ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. So it could be that the wife is removed from this list because though she should not be craved for, she was not part of the legal lists of the day when it was talking about things. Now, I wonder if each of these could be reasons that Moses uses the list of the day for possessions in order to make clear that God's original instruction intended that nothing possessed by a neighbor should be coveted. But in doing so, he's also making clear that the wife has a special place as no mere possession. So, the order is different. Second, the list is different. Did you notice that? So after wife, there is a list of possessions, and that is different. There is one extra item that's added in Deuteronomy that was not mentioned in Exodus. Anybody notice what that was?
Field.
It's the field. Yeah. The field was not mentioned in Exodus, but it is in Deuteronomy. So I wrestled with the reason for this change as well. At first, because I noticed how Hebrew structured the sentence, I thought that the house was like the broad term, and then the other terms filled out the specifics of the neighbor's household. So like, don't covet your neighbor's household. Here's what I mean by that. His field, his servants, all these things. But as I thought about it more, since the wife was clearly separated and put first, it would make sense that that is what the household could be, but I ended up going a different direction. In short, this list, with field included, is specifically suited for life in the land. So think about this. When it was initially given at Mount Sinai, how much land were the people possessing in the Sinai desert? How many fields did they have there? The answer is zero. They didn't have fields. Right now, they're on the plains of Moab, about to have a land that's flowing with milk and honey, where they already have an inheritance, they already have a possession. And so in Deuteronomy, house becomes an item and field is added because each of these will be part of life in the land. In Sinai, household, in Exodus 20, excuse me, house probably was a general term. Here's everything you possess. But as they're going into the land, house now is an item. They're not going to be dwelling in tents anymore around Mount Sinai. They're going to have houses, they're going to have lands, they're going to have possessions. So, I'm not saying that we should think of Moses changing what God said, but rather that he's clarifying the intention for their new context in the land. Now, Jamie and I were talking about this, and she said, well, are you sure it was Moses who changed it? Couldn't the Lord have changed this? And that could quite possibly be the case. We know that Moses, after Sinai, had many interactions with the Lord at the tent of meeting. So either Moses is clarifying what it is in the, for life in the land from those 10 words, or the Lord told him in those conversations, now for life in the land. That, so regardless of which it is, I believe that that's the reasoning. So there's a different order. There's a different list. And then one really interesting thing that it's almost impossible to miss if you're reading this in Hebrew is that there's actually different vocabulary. I tried to bring this out in my translation. The NAS tries to bring it out as well. Look at Deuteronomy 5:21 up there. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, and you shall not desire your neighbor's house. I did this by saying you will not crave the wife and you will not desire the house. So what happens is in Exodus, the word covet is the same word as the first word covet in Deuteronomy 5. But then when it talks about desiring the neighbor's house, that's a totally different word. So the question is, why would this be the case? Why would there be two different words for desiring? And so what I want to do now is I want to take most of the rest of our time to focus on these two different words. Let's get an understanding of what this is negating for us with our neighbor. So here are the two synonyms. I've translated them. I'll put this back up. Crave. Do not crave the wife of your fellow man. This is the same word that's used in Exodus. And then desire. Crave has the idea of desiring something. In some contexts, the idea of taking pleasure in something might be included as well. This is a desire to experience the pleasure that something or someone might offer. A desire to experience the pleasure that something or someone might offer. It could be positive, it could be negative. So I think the word crave could be an appropriate translation. There are times that you crave. I actually think one of the times that this is used, if I'm not mistaken, is when David is craving water. So it can be an appropriate craving, or it can be an inappropriate one. But God is saying that individuals should not desire pleasure that would come from possessing a neighbor's wife, if we could put it that way. This is the same word that Exodus uses. Let's talk about the other one now. Do not desire field or any of these other things. This word does not appear in Exodus. It basically means desire, but it does not have to be a wrong desire either, though in this case it definitely is. These are two words that can be used in either positive or negative circumstances, but the context makes clear that this is a negative type of desire. So, clearly we're talking about what the Bible calls coveting, desiring something that someone else possesses for myself. God does not want his people craving a neighbor's wife, and he does not want them desiring any possessions of a neighbor either. So I had planned throughout the week, and I spent a lot of time developing a question that's going to be in many of our minds. I'm saying that this list after wife is talking about possessions or property. And one of the struggles that's in all of our minds right now is that there are people in that list, right? Male servant and female servant. And we're calling that a list of property or possessions. I really wanted to take an aside to talk about the Bible and slavery. But the more I got into it, the more I thought a small aside might do more harm rather than good. And so I'm just going to ask you to just say a couple of things, or to think through a couple of things. If you read through just Deuteronomy, and Deuteronomy's talk about how slavery, servanthood worked in Israel, let me just give you a few things. You can jot down these passages. These are some of the primary passages in Deuteronomy that talk about slavery. Now, there are many more in the rest of the Pentateuch, and I would have to take all of those into account, and I can't do that today. So let me just tell you some things that Deuteronomy says about slavery. This is an institution, let me just start by this. This is an institution that was overseen and regulated by God himself and that showed concern for both parties. Okay? First of all, the blessings of life in the land were to be shared with servants. That's one of the things we have to recognize. Let me give you some examples. First, Deuteronomy 5:14. We saw this in the 10 words. The Sabbath was to be enjoyed by the servants, just like the head of household. Let me read this to you again. The seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You, landholder, head of household, will do no work on that day. Don't let your son or your daughter do it either, or your male slave or female slave. They get the day off too. Okay? Sabbath was to be enjoyed. Secondly, the joy of worship is not to be denied to servants. They are to enjoy this like the rest of the family. This would be from Deuteronomy 12:10-12. Listen to this. When you cross the Jordan and live in the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, and he gives you rest from all your enemies, then it shall come about that the place in which the Lord your God will choose for his name to dwell, there you shall bring everything I command you, your burnt offerings, sacrifices, tithes, contribution of your hand. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you, your sons, your daughters, your male and female slaves. Do not keep out your slaves from enjoying the worship of the true God. You could also put down Deuteronomy 12:17-18. This is going to say that the servants get to partake of the choice food that's offered before the Lord. You may remember that as part of these feasts, sometimes there would be fellowship meals where you actually get to partake in some of the food that you offered to the Lord. These would be rich feasts. And guess what? God says in Deuteronomy 12:17-18 that your male and female slaves are part of that. It's like they're part of the family. Also, Deuteronomy 16 talks about the three major feasts of Israel. Verses 11 and 14, and I would argue it's assumed in verse 4 as well, where in all three major feasts of Israel, the slaves are participating as well. All right, so we have the Sabbath was to be enjoyed by them, the joy of worship is not to be denied to servants, and then third, this was a system that actually provided maybe what I could say for the upward mobility of these slaves at the conclusion of his time, because the master was to lavishly provide for him to branch out on his own after years of faithful service. Listen to Deuteronomy 15:12-15. If your fellow countryman, a Hebrew man or woman, is sold to you, he shall serve you for 6 years, but in the seventh year you shall set him free. And when you set him free, you shall not send him away empty-handed. You shall give generously to him from your flock, your threshing floor, your wine vat, you shall give to him as the Lord your God has blessed you. Remember, you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. So again, without getting into all the details, this person serves for 6 years, is set free in the seventh, and is lavishly supported on their way out. Let me give you one more. God assumes that this system will produce slaves who don't want to leave the arrangement, but would rather live on in slavery than be free on their own. Listen to Deuteronomy 15:16-17. It shall come about if he says to you, I will not leave you, because he loves you and your household, since he is doing well with you. Then you shall take an awl pierced through his ear into the door, and he shall be your servant permanently. You shall do the same to your female slave. The Bible assumes that this practice will bring some people to say, I don't want to stop this. This is so much better for me and my family than anything we could do out on our own. All right. Slavery in the Old Testament needs a whole lesson and maybe a couple. I think I need to stop there. But here's all I want to say. That though this would be included in what many would say are property lists, this was not intended by God to be what comes into our mind when we think of racial chattel slavery in the American South. That's the main thing I want to communicate today. We're talking about two totally different things. Now, I also want to say this. I am under no impression that this is always how it happened on the ground. But if it happened differently, that was sinful and not as God intended, right? So hopefully that's enough to just say why male and female servant appears in this list. All right. Usually what I do at this time is I talk through the way that this principle is fleshed out in the Book of the Covenant in Exodus, the Holiness Code of Leviticus, and the Statutes and Judgments of Deuteronomy. Though we could argue that maybe there is a way that it's done in Deuteronomy, I would argue in general, we don't find that this one is fleshed out in the same way that the others are throughout the Pentateuch. So why would that be? Why, as we've worked through, we have seen pretty consistently that these commands are fleshed out in particular ways. Why would this one not be? Well, here's what I want to ask. Could it be that it's because this sin is at the root of the others? I want you to notice how it can be very influential in sins prohibited by the previous four commands. So if we go back, look back through the previous four commands, they are false testimony, theft, adultery, and murder. Okay? I want to show you that coveting is really at the root of each of these sins. Think about it. False testimony begins, at least on occasions, like with Ahab, by coveting the field or vineyard of a fellow man. So I'm not going to read it. I had it here. 1 Kings 21, if you want to mark it down. King Ahab cedes a field that he wants. He can't buy it. And so what he does is he ends up having these two people give false testimony about Naboth so that he's killed so that he can then go and take the land. False testimony begins by coveting. Theft begins by coveting the ox of your fellow man. Where does theft start? Well, you see something, you know, see, want, grab, right? Theft begins with coveting in the heart. Adultery clearly starts with coveting the wife of your fellow man. Just ask David what happened that evening that he wasn't even supposed to be home, where he goes out on his rooftop and he sees Bathsheba bathing. He begins by desiring her, craving her, and then going and taking her. And 2 Samuel would also say that murder can begin with covetousness. What does he do after he covets Bathsheba and takes her? He then kills her husband. So what I'm getting at is that it's not just offenses that a neighbor that begin, they can begin in the heart, but it's also offenses against God. Two chapters later in Deuteronomy, in Deuteronomy 7, verse 25, we read this. The carved images of their gods you shall burn with fire. You shall not covet the silver or the gold that is on them, or take it for yourselves, lest you be ensnared by it. It's an abomination to the Lord your God. So even offenses against God begin with coveting. They see a silver or gold statue and they say, that'd be really nice to have. Even if just for the gold, they take it. And that begins their adulterous, idolatrous relationship with a false god. So all I'm trying to say is maybe the reason that coveting is not fleshed out like the others is because coveting is at the foundation of the others. That this is an internal attitude that there's something that I think keeps coming up on the screen up here. Are you guys seeing something? So there's this internal attitude that is then expressed in all of these negative ways externally. Whereas if you're thinking about the Jewish law system, they cannot convict for coveting, but they can for murder and false witness. Those are the externals, but they begin internally. All right, so we got to get to our point. So how would we state the principle? Every week we're trying to do this. What is the lesson? We're pretty familiar with the idea of not coveting, and yet throughout the study we've tried to give both a positive and negative statement to each of these principles. Here's how I stated the negative side. Don't desire your neighbor's loss for your gain. Seems to be a pretty good way to talk about what coveting is. But what would this positive side be? Here I want to bring up another verse that we looked at recently, Leviticus 19:17. You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You shall surely reprove your neighbor, but you shall not incur sin because of him. We talked about that last time. But here's the next verse. You shall not take vengeance, nor bear a grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. What I'm pointing out here is that both of these are talking about the heart. Don't hate in your heart. Don't bear a grudge, but instead love your neighbor as yourself. You probably notice that this is the Lord's verse that he pulls out as the second great commandment. We got the focus here is on the heart. Just as the problem is internal, so the solution at least begins internally. No longer covet or have a grudge or hate, but now start with love. So that love flows out in actions the same way coveting, hating, and grudge would. So, I think the positive, it's right there. It's already there for you. Live by rejoicing in God's blessing on your neighbor. If you love them, you're going to rejoice in God's blessing upon them. If you are not to desire your neighbor's loss for your increase, then what you need to begin doing is actually rejoicing when your neighbor receives blessing from the Lord instead of desiring that blessing would have been yours. And what this does is it immediately brings God into the picture. Because this is very often with coveting, we just have two people involved. We have me and we have my neighbor. We have me and the person who has what I want. But we have to remember there's someone else here. There's the person who determined what I have and what they have, and that's God. And it's in that time that we have to remember that God is the one that's chosen what they have. God is the one who has chosen what we have. You see, it's not as if you live in a careless universe where things just randomly happen. No, you live in a universe where God providentially works in every single activity. Therefore, this blessing on your neighbor, his prosperity, is overseen by God himself. Surely your neighbor worked for those donkeys and the ox. Yes, he put out the time and the resources to construct that house. And yes, he inherited that land because of the tribe he was born into. And if we want to add one more, of course, there is a story about how he and his wife got together. But God is over all these details. God has prospered this individual in these ways for his purposes. This really is none of your business. Just as God has worked with you in a particular way in order to accomplish his purposes through your life, so he has done with others, even your neighbor. So let's get to where we can apply this and then move toward the handout. I'm just really going to quickly say this. As we apply it, we find in the New Testament that covetousness is linked to unbelief and false worship. I have a number of passages here, but I'm not going to be able to go through all of them. Let me give you three things, and then I'll give you the references if you want to look them up. Three ways that this is the case in the New Testament. Conviction about covetousness was central to Paul's conversion and Christian testimony. This shows how central how negative coveting is. Paul mentions that central to both his conversion and then to his Christian character was a reality about coveting. Romans 7, 7 and 8, Paul says this, I would not have known that I was a sinner unless the law told me, don't covet. But when it did, I found it everywhere in my life. And then he says in Acts 20, 33, he says to the elders of Ephesus, he says, I've coveted no one's silver or gold or clothes. You've seen me. You've worked with me for years. You know that that was not my motivation. I was not in this for what I could get. Central to his Christian conviction. Second, covetousness is a sin that is incongruous with Christian testimony. The two just do not go together. Listen to 1 Corinthians 5, 10 and 11. I did not mean, Paul says, that you just totally stop associating with immoral people of this world, with the covetous and the swindlers or the idolaters, for then you'd have to go out of this world. But, actually, I wrote to you not to associate with any so-called brother if he is immoral or covetous or an idolater, a reviler, or drunkard. Paul says this, you can't help but being with covetous, drunken, wicked people out there. But what I'm telling you is that it is incongruous for an individual to call themselves a believer and to be those type of things. Covetousness just does not fit with Christian testimony. Finally, the harsh reality is this. Covetous people won't be in the kingdom. Ephesians 5:5. This you know with certainty. No immoral or impure person or covetous man who's an idolater has an inheritance of the kingdom of Christ and God. Same thing as 1 Corinthians 6, 9, and 10. I won't read that one. So, how then do we obey the 10th word? Well, begin looking to give, not get. If everything is centered on us, then we are going to be covetous people. But if we really begin to take in the truth that life is about God and others, then we are going to begin looking at how then do we serve those around us instead of get from those around us. And the reality is that is exactly how Jesus lived his life. Mark 10:45 says this, "Even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." If there was ever a person who could rightly desire everything, it's the Lord Jesus. And yet he came to give. So, if we allow ourselves to be constantly trained in a perspective that centers upon ourselves, we will be covetous. But, so, we have to take opportunities to find ways to engage ourselves in serving other people. This practice will solidify in reality what we know theologically, that God has richly blessed us with everything we need to serve Him and more. Therefore, we don't need to look to our neighbor to provide what we lack. Instead, we can be like Christ and seek to be the means by which He provides for others. And so, we finish by saying, do not live to be served, but to serve. The covetous life is a life that's looking to be served, to have your neighbor serve you by desiring his property and his possessions. Do not live to be served, but to serve. At this time, men, could you go ahead and come forward and pass out those handouts? I think I need, if I'm going to get through talking about this, I need to do it now. So, I'm going to stop there with the lesson. Don't live to be served, but to serve. Now, I want you to take a look at the handout that you're getting. Excuse me. I'm just going to point out a few things about the handout. What I've done, first of all, you know in the spring, we went through the front side. It's hard to... The front is the one that says the words of life, God's instruction for covenant relationship. So if you've been with us all last year, you already saw this side. I made a few changes with it, but you're pretty familiar with that. So if you flip around, the back side is the 10 words of life side, and I want you to maybe focus there with me for a little bit. I want to show you a few things about it. I hope that this handout can help be really an overview of Deuteronomy for you, because at least after next week, we're going to be done with Deuteronomy. You know, I don't know when we would come back. So we may not come back. We're going to start it. I'll be announcing in our morning service about the new series that will start in a few weeks, but it won't be regarding Deuteronomy. So hopefully this can be a helpful handout to remind us of what we've learned and to be an overview of this book for us. So let's talk about this side. Let's look at the headings, first of all, those words in bold across the top. There are four of them that grow across the top of the handout. The first is word. This designates the number of each word, so like word or command 1, command 2, word 3, and then the title of that lesson. So if you look there, you see word number 1, no other gods. We entitled the first lesson, No Other Gods. Also below that, you'll see the appropriate verse numbers so that you can find that easily. The next heading over is translation. This is the translation that I used each week for our study. And if you'll remember, I called it a jarring translation. My intent was not to say that I am a better translator than all the translations committees of whatever translation you hold in your hand, because I obviously am not. Rather, this was a helpful exercise for me in my study to wrestle with every word and then to try to put it in an English form that tried to keep some of the foreign feel of the original. My goal is that this would bring us to approach it as if we hadn't read it before. That's why I did it in this way. Now, you may feel that this column is not helpful for you, so just skip over it. The third is principle. Everything in this category should be somewhat familiar. This was the twofold principle that we identified each week, the positive and the negative statement of it. We would state that lesson in both forms, and maybe this can jog your memory about the significance of that word for your spiritual life. The final column is application. This is meant to help us take that final step to application. This column contains a primary application that we discussed for that commandment. Obviously, I couldn't give all the specifics that we discussed, but hopefully this will at least jog our mind to a way that we can apply it in our New Covenant, New Testament age. Next, I want to talk now going down the handout. There are three sections that you can probably discern. First, you can see some bars before and after word number 5. Hopefully you see that. Word number 5 seems to be kind of set out. Why is that? Well, this sets apart the first 4 commands, isolates the 5th, and then brings together number 6 through 10. So why did I do that around number 5? Well, if you remember back to when we discussed that one, you'll remember that there's a lot of debate whether command number 5 goes with the first 4 that focus on our relationship to God, or whether that goes with the last 6, the last 5 that go with our relationship to one another. And in that lesson, I said I really believe it's a bridge that connects both. I think the reason that we see similarity with each is because it's intended as a bridge to connect us to both. And so that's what I've tried to do visually, is to show that that's a connecting point between the two. All right, one more thing. What about these dotted lines and at the top? In essence, what that's supposed to show is that, if you remember, there is, even among good Christian people, some debate about how those first couple are numbered. And that is, in essence, my attempt to try to show that. If you want to know the specifics about what all those communicate, I can talk to you afterwards. But, yeah. Okay, let me then just sum it all up. Let me sum it all up this way. If we are then going to take even what we've visually reproduced on this form, what are our takeaways from all of these lessons? Well, if I had to boil it down to 3, if I had to take this overview that I've just shown you visually, how would I state the takeaways? Well, here they are, 3 of them. Number 1, from the first 4, centralize the Lord in your life. Centralize the Lord in your life. He must be central. He must be primary. And the way that this would be expressed, if we take everything to bear, here is how those 4 commands would say that. How do I centralize the Lord in my life, we ask? Well, here it is. Number 1, worship Him alone. Number 2, don't conform to society's worship norms. 3, take seriously your representation of Him. And 4, let His rest characterize your life. Now, you'd have to go back, and we'd have to go back and talk through each of our lessons about how that fleshes out, but that's how you centralize God in your life. So my second main exhortation that would come out of this would be from word number 5, that bridge one, and it would be this: respect those whom God respects. And if we're going to get really specific, we'd say it like this: the way you treat your parents says about a lot about how your life and society will go. The way you treat your parents says a lot about how your life and society as a whole will go. So, centralize the Lord in your life, respect those whom God respects, and then here, number 3, prioritize your neighbor. Prioritize your neighbor. And we're going through number 6, never take his life in action or in emotion. And for these, I'm trying to bring the New Testament in. Don't murder him actually, but Jesus would say, don't murder him in anger in your heart either. Right? That's what this is saying. We saw that both of those. We read even in the Old Testament, don't hate him in your heart. So, don't kill your neighbor, never take his life in action or in emotion. 7, never take his wife in your head or into your bed. Now, I say that in a quip, but both are realities. We saw it in the Old Testament, we saw it in the New. Don't do it up here, and don't do it in reality. Number 8, never take his stuff. I put it like this, by fight or by night. Whether you go in by robbery and you say, give it to me or else, or you do it secretively. Don't do it either way. We saw both of those as we went through those commands. Number 9, never take his trial. Here's what I mean. We talked about don't bear false witness. That means don't take away his justice from him. And I'm going to say that in court or in public. And here's what we mean. We saw that there were two ways you could do this. You could do it by standing up under oath, so to speak, and giving false testimony. Or you could just go slander him in public and, in essence, not even give him a trial, right? So never take his trial in court or in public. And then finally, number 10, never put yourself first. It's God, then him. Never put yourself first. It's God, then him. Centralize the Lord in your life. Respect those whom God respects. And prioritize your neighbor. And that, and along with what we've seen in covenanting today, gives us more than enough to think about and to pray about as we conclude. Let's pray.